first of all, I would like to introduce the members of our distinguished panel tonight. George Borjas is professor of economics and social policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. And George is also the author of several excellent books on immigration. And next to George, we have Bridget Cavain, who is our very own professor of Latin American and Latino studies right here at Montana State University. And Bridget is very active in Gallatin County, working to create better services for our Latino population. Finally, we also have Andrew Greenfield, who is an immigration attorney and managing partner of Fragaman Worldwide in Washington, D.C. And Andrew currently serves on the board of Brand USA, which is a congressional partnership to promote international tourism to the U.S. For our audience to become familiar with our panelists, we'd like to give them 5 minutes each to just tell us what their perspective is on the topic for tonight. George, would you like to kick it off for us?
Of course. Thank you so much, Nancy, okay? I've been thinking all day today, actually, as to how to present myself. And I've sort of come down to a decision that I'm going to tell a little anecdote before I get to the economics of immigration. And it's an anecdote that has a real value because it really teaches you what's at stake in the immigration debate, which all of you have heard, I'm sure, in the media all the time. But this is an anecdote that actually happened. I know somebody who was in the room when this happened, and they've told me it's correct. And it happened in January or something like that, 1979, when Jimmy Carter was president. And Jimmy Carter invited Deng Xiaoping, who was then the vice premier of China, the power in China, to Washington for the first time. It was the very first time that that high-level official from Red China, from Communist China, the old Communist China, had visited the U.S. And Jimmy Carter, as all of you know, was very concerned about human rights violations in China and all over the world. And in fact, he had prepared a dossier, like a big notebook, full of things that he wanted to bring up with Deng Xiaoping at the White House meeting. And indeed, the White House meeting took place, and Jimmy Carter opened this notebook, and there were page after page of human rights violations that Jimmy Carter thought China should address before China could move ahead and join the modern world, in some sense, right? And page by page they went, and they eventually got to the page about immigration. And as some of you might know, communist countries prevented their citizens from leaving for many, many years. And China was no different. And Jimmy Carter basically told Deng Xiaoping, you know, but Vice Premier, how can you expect China to sort of join the modern world of, you know, of civilized countries in some sense if you don't allow your people to go? And Deng Xiaoping thought for a minute and said, you know, Mr. President, you're absolutely right. How many Chinese nationals do you want? True story. That ended the conversation about immigration from China right there and then. Now, the reason I want to make that point is that because despite everything you hear in the media about what the debate is about, that is one of the two crucial questions that anybody who's really serious about immigration has to address in the debate. And there's a second question. Suppose Jimmy Carter had actually thought about this for even 10 seconds prior to the meeting with Deng Xiaoping. You know, he could have said, maybe we need so many Chinese nationals with this level of skills, so many programmers, so many this, so many that, right? And the point is, Deng Xiaoping could have said, well, if you don't give me who you want, we have a billion people to choose from. Which million do you want to pick? And that's the second question in the immigration debate. Many, many more people want to come to the U.S. than most reasonable policy positions would allow, and we have to decide, how do we pick? You know, there has to be a decision of how many immigrants will come, and how do we pick those lucky people who are going to come to the U.S.? Now, in my career, I focused on this from the economic aspect of all this, and there's a lot of disagreement among economists about the second of these questions. Believe it or not, there's nothing in economics that tells you the answer to the first question, which is how many people to admit. We just simply do not know what the right number is from an economic perspective. But there is an answer to the second question. If all you cared about was the economic impact of immigration, and by that you meant improving the economic well-being of the people already here, then it's very clear from an economic perspective that what we should do is try to fashion an immigration policy where the people we admit tend to be very highly skilled. Those are the people who will make the country much wealthier. As human beings, however, we're not all economists. And we have to realize that by making that choice, you're really making a very strong value judgment. And what I want to say is, something we have to really think about is, what do you really want to accomplish from immigration policy? Do you want to just look at economics? Or are there more important things in life than economics that should make, that would lead to a more American immigration policy that would satisfy the American people? It's not clear that economics is the answer to all things. Thank you.
Thank you, George, very much. Thank you. Bridget, would you be next for us?
Thank you, Nancy, and thank you, George. I think I'm here to add a different piece of the puzzle in what is immigration. I've been at Montana State University for more than 20 years now, and I think I can pinpoint the year which, to me, kind of became a watershed year in Gallatin County, and that was around 2006 when Gallatin County, or employers in Gallatin County, did decide to welcome mostly Mexican workers to work in the county. So what was the reason for this? Many of you know that Bozeman in particular, but Big Sky as well, and the Yellowstone Club have transformed this county in terms of their amenities and what kind of lifestyle we promote and promise to those that come here. And in order to fulfill that promise, there's a need for labor. Today in Montana, we have about 34,000 mostly Mexican Latinos. In Gallatin County, the percentage is about 3,000. And it's seen tremendous growth since the 2000s. And 2006, again, I'm using that as my watershed year, was the year where service providers in the county noticed an uptick in non-English-speaking patients, non-English-speaking parents in the schools, all kinds of workers going to the food bank, and in large part due to Buck Taylor from Community Health Partners, there was a loose coalition of providers in the county that started to come together to figure out how to provide for these people. And this is the human side of immigration, in the sense that these people were here to work, and many of them decided to stay and set down roots, and what was Gallatin County going to do about that? So they're also, those are, I think, parts of the puzzle that George is raising here, is who are we going to let in? And then once they're here, I would add, what are we going to do to make sure that their outcome, or the county's outcome, or the state's outcome, is positive, that everyone benefits from it? With every group that comes in, there, of course, are some that go back and some that set down roots. And those are the ones that really we want to integrate into our community. I think many of you probably know that Montana has a very long history of Hispanics, Latinos in the state, more than 200 years. And so there's this pattern of inviting workers to work in agriculture, or inviting workers to work. I'm sure many of you have heard of the sugar beet industry in Billings, and Great Western imported about 1,000 Mexican workers. And then, of course, this pattern has not disappeared. It's happening right now in Gallatin County. So I do have quite a bit of experience working with the community, but it's a whole host of people that have worked with the community here in Gallatin County, from Community Health Partners, Gallatin County Health, the food bank, the Ellen in the Bozeman School District. And I think that's what I'm here to offer, is that portrait, the snapshot of Latinos in Montana.
Thank you, Bridget. And Andrew, we'd love to hear from you.
All righty. So first I want to say that the last time I visited Bozeman was 1989. So I apologize if I don't recognize many of you. But I think we've all gotten a little older. But please come by and tell me where you were in August of 1989, and we'll see if we cross paths. So I'm the East Coast corporate attorney coming to Montana to talk about employment-based immigration and what our system looks like. And I guess just a couple of things. One, the Congress is the only branch of the federal government that has the constitutional authority to create immigration laws and to create laws that regulate the flow of foreign-born people into the United States. And I'm sure it's not going to be a surprise to anyone in the room that Congress can get very little done these days. And when it comes to hot-button issues like immigration, even less gets done. I mean, you know, we had a couple of years of what would seem to be, you know, both houses of Congress and the White House and the same party, and it didn't make a difference. And so now with a divided Congress, you know, my hope of any meaningful immigration reform from Congress is very, very dim. But we do have statutes on the books, and then we have federal agencies from the Department of State, Department of Labor, and Department of Homeland Security that regulate immigration programs in the United States, and employees of these agencies are doing the best they can with the laws and regulations on the books to operate these programs. And I wanted to just sort of give you some numbers to think about. Yesterday was the annual deadline for U.S. employers to file H-1B work permit applications for foreign professionals. I don't know, just by a show of hands, is anyone familiar with the H-1B program or heard of it? So the statute allows 85,000, it gives the Department of Homeland Security authorization to issue 85,000 new H-1B work permits to foreign professionals every year. And yesterday, the numbers haven't been announced yet, but I have a decent idea that USCIS will have received 200,000 requests for those 85,000, and it's been about 200,000 for the last couple of years, and then it was 236,000 and 230,000 before that. So it's just a fact that a huge percentage of American employers that are seeking to recruit and retain foreign professional talent, meaning foreign-born people that have at least a bachelor's degree or higher in a particular field, and it's very often in STEM fields for which the United States does not, unfortunately, do a great job of inspiring our young people to go into STEM fields the way they do in countries like India and China. So there's a real mismatch between the supply and demand of professional workers. And then in addition, the statute also allows 140,000, it allocates 140,000 residency visas or green cards every year for foreign nationals that are sponsored by U.S. employers. But that 140,000 includes the dependents of those foreign nationals that are sponsored. And so when you're sponsored by an employer for a green card, your spouse and any unmarried children under the age of 21 can immigrate with you. And so that's 140,000 in total. And so as a result, sponsored professionals from high-use countries like India and China are currently waiting 10 to 15 years or longer for their permanent residence applications to be approved. And so without even, and I really appreciated the opening talks, without even providing a sort of value opinion on that, you know, I guess we really need to think about what that reality is. You know, is it just, you know, America, U.S. employers just not wanting to hire American professionals because they can get foreign professionals so much cheaper? I can tell you that lawyers like me and the government take a lot of money, charge a lot of money to help these employers bring in these foreign professionals to the United States. And so I don't know that it's such an easy thing to say, well, if they just paid more, there'd be Americans for these jobs. What I hear from my clients is that they're very, very hard to fill. I also wanted to give you just a couple of statistics. You mentioned Brand USA, which is kind of interesting. I was appointed by the Secretary of Commerce to the board of Brand USA as the board's immigration law and policy expert in 2014, and I'm about to complete my second and final term, and I took a little bit about statistics. Now, Brand USA is a destination marketing organization for the United States. So Montana for sure must have, I know it has, a Visit Montana organization that tries to encourage visitors to Montana. Well, Brand USA is that organization for the United States. And so we have about a $200 million a year budget to encourage and invite foreign residents to vacation and visit here. And I want to just give you a little data about that. In 2017, and this is data from the Department of Commerce, we received 77 million international visitors who spent $251 billion in the United States and supported 1.2 million jobs. And this represented 32% of services exports from the United States and 11% of all U.S. exports. And then one other statistic that I think is kind of interesting is that the United States represents 5.8% of worldwide visitation. So if you take a look at the whole world and look at all the countries that people are choosing to visit, 5.8% is our share. And I will tell you that that share is pretty flat these days. Now, there is an economic argument that the strength of the U.S. dollar may be keeping some people from visiting because it's a little bit more expensive. But based on, you know, what we find in a lot of the surveys that the organization does, is that the perception of the United States as a welcoming place to visit or not is an important factor that people use to decide whether they and their families want to visit here. And I think a lot of that trickles up and down and all over to our politics and what people hear and read true or not about the United States. And so I'll leave that data with you just as something to think about, but I think that's all I want to say as an intro.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. All right. It's good to share some statistics and facts together, and, you know, just to help us put this issue in perspective, you know, on the internet, we're told that there are about 44 million immigrants in the U.S. now, and that this is about triple the number that we had in 1970. Of the many ways that immigration impacts the U.S. economy, both positively and negatively, what single factor do you consider most important, and what policy might you recommend to address it? Anybody who's ready? George.
George will take
this one. But we want to hear from you guys, too.
In economic terms, there are two ways that one, sort of primary ways that one has to worry about the economic impact. One is the labor market. You know, immigrants come and they work and they produce a lot of output. So inevitably, more people means higher GDP. That's just the mechanical kind of thing. The usual way that economists look at this is we have to pay the immigrants for their production, so how much is left for everybody else? In other words, what we call the native population. And every economic model will predict that if you just stick to the productive side of things, the labor market side of things, when immigrants come, the economic pie of natives actually expands for exactly the same reason that trade expands the economic pie of the country. You know, we're importing things, we're paying them, but they actually produce a little more than we're paying them. So we, as workers and as people who own the capital, actually have a bigger economic pie to deal with. But not everybody gains, and that's one of the important lessons of economics. You know, there's no policy in the world where everybody's happier as a result of the change in policy. And immigration is no exception. So when immigrants come in, what usually happens is people who compete with immigrants for those kinds of jobs are going to have a harder time getting a job. And employers don't have to pay as much for the H-1B or not. That's part of the big the debate in the H-1B visa. You know, employers don't have to pay as much to get up to hire a programmer. So the people who are doing the jobs that immigrants would have done will lose a little bit. But on the other hand, the employers who are now able to buy labor at a cheaper wage rate, and eventually the consumers actually who consume those things, they will tend to gain. So one of the crucial things about immigration is that the gains and losses are not distributed equally. Okay, some people gain, some people lose, and the way I like to phrase this usually is people who compete with immigrants tend to lose out, which makes sense. And people who use immigrants tend to win, which also makes sense. And that's from the labor market perspective. At the same time, and another very important economic part of all this is the fiscal impact. And the fiscal impact is important in a couple of ways. One is immigrants come in, you know, I'm not gonna say they come in because they wanna get on welfare or anything like that. It could be the normal people like you and I, right? They come in and things happen to us. We get sick, we have accidents. And people at every point in life, you know, no matter who you are, at some point you need help. And the government is here to provide the help through the welfare system and the public assistance system. At the same time, immigrants pay taxes. So you have to sort of look at what the combination of taxes they pay and services they receive will be. And in the short run, because a lot of immigrants, you know, you mentioned like 44 million immigrants or something like that, right? A big chunk of them, at least 30% probably, tend to have less than a high school degree. So that, you know, immigration, we do get a lot of highly skilled immigrants, but we also get many, many more low-skilled immigrants. And those are the people from whom the public assistance system was actually designed to help and protect. So they cost money. Now, that's in the short run. You also have to think about the long run. Because the fact of the matter is people like me, a baby boomer, are going to retire. And we have to worry about who's going to pay for my retirement. And more people is better in that way because they have more taxpayers. But the problem with that perspective is that the way that the Social Security system in the U.S. is sort of set up, at some point, even though the current immigrants who are coming in will help pay for my retirement, those immigrants will retire one day and all their money that they put in, they went to me. So what's going to happen 30 years from now when they're ready to retire? So that argument doesn't really work very well. So the fiscal impact is almost certainly at least not positive and probably negative. And therefore, what you really end up with is a situation where the gains and from the productivity side and the losses from the fiscal impact, you know, probably outweigh each other. You know, it's probably a wash. But the distributional impact could be substantial. In other words, the people who compete with immigrants are going to lose out, and the people who use immigrants are going to gain. And if you sort of see the immigration debate in that context, it takes you pretty far. And the question we have to decide is, you know, who are you rooting for? Are you rooting for the workers? Are you rooting for the employers? Are you rooting for the immigrants? Immigrants clearly gain a lot. You know, otherwise they wouldn't come. And that's the moral choice we have to make.
If I could just sort of layer on that, because George makes a really good and interesting point. You know, while sort of the micro world that I live in with employment-based immigration, you know, is sufficient to keep a lot of us busy, I think the most recent statistic I saw is that if you look at the entire population of foreign nationals that immigrate to the United States legally, 80% or so are from family-based immigration. They're not from employment-based immigration. And while people throw around words like chain migration, which is not a word I particularly like, family unity is, or family reunification is, one of the age-old underlying policies of the U.S. immigration system. And so U.S. citizens and to some extent permanent residents or green card holders are permitted to sponsor close family members to immigrate to the United States. And to George's point, or at least your implicit point, right, they're not coming because someone's identified a skill that they have that's needed in the economy. And so they will, you know, compete for jobs that they're able to get. And so I guess that is an important element to keep in mind.
Very good.
Here's our next question. How might you agree or disagree with the statement, our economy cannot grow without immigrants? Our economy cannot grow without immigrants.
You want to take a stab at it?
Go for it, George.
George is helping us tonight.
There was very little immigration in this country between 1924 and 1965. Nobody thinks of the 1950s as a period of no growth. So the historical experience just it's not really consistent with that. That's what I would say.
And what I'll also say is that when I talk to the CEOs of high-tech companies who are struggling to retain or recruit a sufficient number of workers because of the H-1B quota, the economic decisions that many of them are making is to offshore more work, right? Is to take more work overseas, which employs people overseas, where people earn salaries and spend them overseas. And I think we need to really think hard about the consequences, the economic consequences of a restrictionist approach to immigration, especially when it comes to certain sectors of the economy, because, you know, the power of business is a strong one. And if businesses to survive have to take their operations to Ireland or India, they're going to do it.
Very good. Well, maybe we could take Bozeman as an example. Bridget, you know, how would you summarize the opportunity and challenge that immigration presents here?
So I guess, you know, as I briefly touched on, Montana is an ag state, and I'm not an economist, I'm not an immigration expert, but I tend to believe, for example, the dairy farmers in Manhattan or Amsterdam that post job opportunities for people to milk cows. And by the way, they pay $80 a shift, more or less, and a shift goes from 2 a.m. to 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. to 2 a.m. I mean, maybe that's not a competitive wage, but regardless, the only people that they have been able to find, and I don't know when I'd place this, maybe it was the 2000s, maybe it has been since the recession and then the uptick, are Mexican workers. And that has been true in Montana historically for Great Western Sugar, the sugar beet workers. It was true for the traqueros, the people that laid the tracks for the railroad. It's been true for many different industries, including flathead cherries, which we all love and can't wait till they're in the supermarkets. Those are picked mostly by Mexicans coming in from Eastern Washington. So, I mean, I don't know if it's an opportunity, but I think from the employer standpoint, it's an opportunity. I would say for the people that coming here, it's an opportunity as well. The community that I've worked with, I can say pretty bluntly, they're here to work. It's many do not feel comfortable accessing anything that has to do with welfare because for different reasons. Sometimes it's a linguistic barrier, sometimes it's the isolation of where they live, et cetera. But it's an opportunity to come here also for the same reason that it's an opportunity for us to live here. Everything that we love about Bozeman, they are finding is reason to love about Bozeman as well. And challenges, am I still on my question? What was the other part?
Yes, absolutely. Could you summarize the challenge that immigration seems to present here?
I mean, I'm not sure if you mean by challenges, whether there a challenge is that it's taking jobs away or whether it's a challenge to actually be an immigrant in the state.
Well, I mean, I think you've addressed the issue of not, you know, taking jobs away. It sounds like what you're saying, Bridget, is that there aren't people here, enough people here, to want those jobs, so they're not taking anybody's job away. Before we get off of that, I wonder if there's any, you think there's any depression of the wage?
You know, that is a question that George will have to address. I mean, I don't know. I think I don't know. Maybe that's something you could address too.
I certainly know about the people that do the cherries. I can't.
Yeah.
I can't tell you about those cherries that you mentioned that sound delicious.
They're wonderful.
I you know, in terms of depression of agricultural wages, I don't know. I'd be interested to know the answer, but I don't know.
I mean, we have a wage problem across America. It's not just with people coming in to work. I think in the dairy farms, they pay a competitive wage. Could they pay more? Of course. But as you know, dairy farmers are also losing. They're losing. People are drinking less milk. There's, I think, more open trade of milk. But I'll defer to George. I'm not an economist.
No, the fact of the matter is that there really are no economic studies of what happened in Bozeman as a result of immigration to the wage.
Yet.
So, it's that simple. The usual study tends to look at a city that receives a lot of immigrants, a city that receives fewer immigrants, and there's a big debate over what that correlation tends to show. So it's not something we really want to get into because there are 1,000 studies. I gave a paper earlier today at MSU, and literally, there are like 1,000 studies that do this, and there are 1,000 different answers. So, you know, just one can pick whichever one you like and then come up with that answer. I think if you just look at common sense and look at the basic flow of where, you know, and look at the H-1B itself, for example, you know, employers lobby an awful lot for H-1Bs. Now, it could well be that, you know, there are not enough people to do that kind of work, which is the argument they make. But, you know, it could also be that deep down they feel that they don't really want to pay a higher wage to attract more people that could have done that job in the first place. And I wouldn't put it past employers, capitalists in that frame, to actually believe that, you know, and act that way. You know, there are two sides to this, and it's not so clear that employers have the best interests of America in mind. Just don't forget that.
Right, true. So something to look into, right?
Yep.
But I would say that the service providers, mostly, especially around health, education, and legal, like status, have the best interests of the people coming in to work at those jobs because many times the employer disenfranchises them or isolates them. So, I mean, maybe an economic point is that those providers also kick into the economy of a town like Bozeman as they create trust amongst the community, and then more and more patients go into these different social sectors. It's, I don't know, just an observation.
Sure. Okay, well, I'd like to take some questions now from our audience. Here's one from an audience member. I have heard that illegal immigration puts substantial strain on our healthcare system as hospitals don't often get paid for treating them. Is this a major issue?
I've heard those concerns raised by people from border states in particular, like Arizona, whether it's the public school systems or the hospital systems. I certainly can't cite chapter and verse or give you you know data on that, but I don't dismiss that as I would imagine just logically that could be a problem because hospitals generally do need to provide at least emergency care to anybody that comes in, right?
There's probably something to the point. Now, what the exact number is very hard to determine. simply because most data sources in the U.S. don't tell us who's legal and who's illegal. So we sort of suspect something like that is going on. And the fact that, look, the fact of the matter is, look, think of the welfare state the way it's established. The welfare state is established to help people who are worse off by getting money from people who are better off. A lot of the illegal immigrants tend to be worse off. And like I said before, it's not that they come here to make use of the resources, but things happen to everybody. And at some point, people need help. And given the way the welfare state works, the people who will need help tend to be people who are less skilled, of whom a lot are illegal. And so it's almost inevitable, actually, that that kind of thing will be true. Mm-hmm. That's actually one of the reasons why I said before that economics, if it teaches us anything about immigration, is that high-skill immigration is actually more economically beneficial mm-hmm. because you don't have that problem. You know, they actually fund the system as opposed to putting a burden on the system.
Right. I also saw on the internet that approximately 40% of undocumented immigrants have no medical insurance, no health insurance. So, you know, there's a need, certainly for emergency, right. as Andrew said. At minimum.
And just if you're concerned in the state at all, there's Montana has, according to the Pew Hispanic Center, less than 5,000 undocumented. But for me, the issue always, the same would be true of anyone that's uninsured. And I think America has a high rate of uninsured individuals. It's no different. But I would say that one of the things that places like Community Health Partners does or Gallatin County Health, just to, again, get back to the local, is to promote community health workers. Those are individuals within the community that then serve as liaisons with Bozeman Deaconess, for example. And the trick is to teach preventative care so that you don't at the last minute decide to take an ambulance to the emergency room, but you've been trained by this community health worker to look out for these issues. And that model has been successful in places like California, and it's been successful here in Gallatin County to a small degree so far.
George, did you want to add anything, or should we move on?
No, I just move on.
Okay, very good.
Questions in.
Sure, here's another question from our audience. How would changes in technology impact the labor force's need for more or fewer immigrant workers? Changes in technology.
So, I mean, nothing is going to stop AI from doing what it's going to do, right? And that question is so much broader than an immigration question, but if any of you are interested, there's somebody that's running for president right now. He's not doing very well in the polls, named Andrew Yang. I don't know if anybody's heard of him, and his big focus is on something called universal basic income, which guarantees every American 18 years or older, $1,000 a month, regardless of whatever else they might make, because he predicts in the relatively near future that a huge sector of the American workers, truck drivers, people that work in call centers, are just not going to have jobs. I want to try to make this relevant to this conversation, but it kind of is. I mean, the truth of the matter is that we're not importing foreign truck drivers, right? And so, in that respect, I think that changes in technology are going to make many, many jobs of today totally obsolete. Now, there still will need to be skilled individuals with expertise in the technology that runs the more advanced technology. And so, you know, there's this very controversial expression. Somebody got kicked off of Twitter a couple of weeks ago for using this expression, learn to code. Has anybody heard about that? Which I didn't realize was such a bad thing to say, but you know, people that throw out learn to code, meaning, you know, the truck drivers should learn to code, right? Which, I mean, I think is ridiculous, you know, because I think if they were really interested in technology, they may not have become truck drivers, right? And so it is a serious economic issue that we will face.
And once again, I'd like to turn to George.
Okay.
Because you must have thought about the impact of AI.
I actually advertised one of my latest papers. I have a paper on this.
Read his paper.
Yeah, with Richard, my colleague is at Harvard, Richard Freeman, and I wrote a paper last September, actually. It hasn't been published yet, but we're still working on it. But it's looking at the robotic revolution and the impact on wages alongside with immigration. And the twist of that paper is that if you look at what we call supply shock, you know, the shock in labor supply, immigrants are a shock on labor supply. There are just many more workers, right? But so are robots. You know, robots are like people, except they don't have a beating heart. So immigration and robots are really two sides of the same kind of thing. And what you find is that immigrants come in and they tend to depress the wage in those industries where they come in. Robots come in, and we have data on that now dating back about 20 years, and they also depress the wages where robots come in. And by looking how much depression is of one group versus the other, you can basically tell how many people are in a robot. And that number is 4 or 5. So now just think about the future. We're just at the beginning of the robotic revolution. Technology will get better, so robots will be even more productive. They'll become a lot cheaper. So, you know, it's going to happen. And the kinds of jobs that robots can do probably will expand as opposed to contract. So now getting to the audience member's question, how does immigration fit in? You know, there's one thing about robots that immigrants cannot compete with. Robots don't get sick. And the day they break down, you throw them out. You don't do that with human beings. You know, and that's going to be a very important policy issue, not right now in the immigration debate, but will become increasingly so in the immigration debate as this trade-off becomes clearer and clearer. So despite everything you hear about the immigration debate being, you know, so emotional and sensitive today, just think, 10 years, it's not the immigrants,
it's the non-humans.
It's going to be even worse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is how different do you think this, just going off script or answer asking another question, I mean, how different is this from the Industrial Revolution, from, you know, when the ag, I mean, do you think it'll flatten out or adjust or whatever the term is?
The actual answer, I mean, there's two points of view. One is, I mean, if you turn the TV on, about robots is either a huge debacle, we are all going to lose our jobs, that's the usual party line, or it's going to work out just like before. That's the other extreme, right? We don't know which will be true. I mean, the Industrial Revolution was true for the Industrial Revolution, right?
Right.
This is a different world, different technology, different kind of skill groups. Whether history repeats itself or not, we will see in 2050.
If it repeats, it's not going to repeat precisely the same way, right?
So
exactly. But that's really something, that's really a very good question because it's really at the core of where the debate will be going in the next 10, 20 years. I mean, and it really raises the fundamental question, you know, how does immigration policy coordinate itself with a technological revolution that's really around the corner? It's already here, but it's going to accelerate.
Right, there are a lot of changes that all of us will need to face together. And, you know, this speaks to the importance of being agile as a society to proactively see the change coming if we can and adapt accordingly. And like you say, immigration policy would be an important, perhaps, chunk of that.
Right.
Very good. Okay, so here's another question for us. How much would a temporary or seasonal worker policy help? Often people cross the border to go back home to their country after the work is done.
So we have one, right? The immigration laws have two types. They have the H-2A program for seasonal agricultural workers and the H-2B program for non-agricultural workers. I'm a little bit more familiar with the non-agricultural worker program. Like the H-1B, they are limited in number every year to 66,000. And the way the government does that, because when you think about seasonal jobs in the United States, And the way that, without going into any detail, the way that the sort of immigration processes work, what the government does is they reserve half or 33,000 for roughly the summer season, right? The resorts in Florida and California, and then the other half for the winter season. We actually represent Vail and their ski lift operators that they have to bring in every year. It is really, really tricky these days to get H-2Bs approved simply because not only is the demand higher than the supply, but you have to first conduct a labor market test to demonstrate that there aren't available U.S. workers. And that's usually successful in these jobs because in a lot of these jobs, like, you know, a pool boy at the Ritz-Carlton in Naples, Florida, right? I mean, you're lucky for people to show up for their interviews. So, I mean, the clients really they really need them. But the difficulty is that if they're not filed at precisely the right time. So the answer to whoever asked that question is we have these temporary worker programs, but they're not real easy to use. Again, if Congress could get its act together and think about these issues and change the laws to make them a little bit more caught up with the American economy, it would be very worthwhile.
Whenever I think about temporary workers, I always remember a quip that a lot of economists who work on temporary migration issues and the impact of temporary migrants always say about temporary workers. And the quote goes something like this: there's nothing more permanent than a temporary immigrant. And, you know, I think discussion about temporary workers are sort of a way out of the difficult issue of determining one of the questions I began my talk with, which is, how many immigrants do we want? Temporary immigrants come in, and we're not the kind of country, and rightly so, that will take a temporary immigrant and get him out of the house and put him in a bus and send him across if they do the slightest bad thing. There's a whole legal system designed to protect them, and rightly so. So temporary migration will really be temporary in countries where all these safeguards don't exist. We don't have that kind of problem. I mean, we don't have that kind of system. We protect people. And I think the correct way to think about this is just to say, look, temporary immigrants come in, they might get married, they might have kids, all kinds of things happen that allow all kinds of legal opportunities to open up eventually. Not right away, but eventually. And that's something to think about. So temporary immigration in the US legal context, it's not really a sensible way to think about things. It's really almost permanent immigration, and we should think about it as permanent immigrants.
Realistically. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, here's our next question. Some countries use a point-based system to rank immigration applicants. What might be the pros and cons of using a point system here in the U.S.?
So I have a point of view about that because I've thought about it deeply. My law firm is in 32 countries, including some countries that use a points-based system. Canada is probably the most obvious example. And President Trump last year, maybe the year before, actually had proposed to Congress that they implement a points-based system. The way that points-based systems work, just as a general matter, is that the federal government takes a look at the labor market, takes a look at what it perceives the United States might need in terms of immigrants, and assigns points to different qualities. So if you've got a bachelor's degree, that's 2 points. If you've got an advanced degree in a particular field, then that's another couple of points. If you're of a certain age, if you have a certain net income or net worth, if you have certain family members and individuals who can demonstrate that they have a certain total number of points are eligible to immigrate to the United States. And the theory and the policy is not a bad one, right? Which is that we can design a system where we're attracting what we think are the best and brightest and needed people to the United States. I strongly opposed and continue to oppose that for the United States because our current employment-based system right now is employer-driven, which means that if a foreign national is being sponsored to come to the United States, it's because a specific employer has determined that it has a need in within its workforce for a particular job with someone with particular skills, and then tests the labor market and demonstrates the unavailability of U.S. workers for those skills. And that's that facilitates the admission of that foreign national into the United States. I'd be concerned if a points-based system would remove from individual employers the ability to control that system. And so, for example, we might have a system that values people with STEM degrees, which we definitely need more of in the United States, right? So you get a lot of points if you've got a master's degree in electronics engineering, great. But it may be that in reality, in a particular city or state or a particular employer, it's really electronics engineers that have experience with particular skill sets that are really important today with the advent of the need for more, you know, data analytics, which we're seeing a lot of these days. And so I'd be reluctant to take that away from individual employers. I like the idea of employers defining their needs rather than Big Brother saying, this is who needs to come in. I have a feeling you're going to disagree.
I disagree because it's actually a very cheap way of filtering the immigrant pool. Right now, like you said before, like I don't know the number exactly, but at least 2/3 of legal immigrants come in without any skill filter whatsoever. All the family, you know, relationship preference immigrants. All the legal immigrants come in without any skill filter whatsoever. So, you know, the bulk of immigrants into the country come in without any skill filter whatsoever. A lot of countries have tried the point system, Canada being one of them, Australia, New Zealand. And one of the reasons you try it is because it's a very simple way of determining whether the applicant, you're going to get millions of applicants. And it's a very simple way of determining whether the applicant qualifies at the level you want them to qualify or not. The usual things they look at are education, which is something we should look at. If what you really care about is attracting skilled immigration, age, which is also something you want to look at if what you really care about is the fiscal impact of immigration. I mean, Canada, for example, one of the questions will be, you know, what's your age? And if you're over 50, you get 0 points. You know, it's just going to be very hard to get in. So things like that matter. And, you know, we know from a lot of economics that those characteristics, they're not the only things that matter in determining productivity, but they matter a lot. So to the extent you want to do that, you might want to try out a point system because it's a very cheap way of doing it. And just to give you an example of how far, you know, you mentioned Canada. Just to give you an example of how far countries go to ensure that they get the kinds of immigrants they want, which, you know, something we would never do in the U.S. probably, but New Zealand, which is not usually thought of as a very repressive kind of country, in the 1990s, they decided that they really wanted people who spoke English, okay? And if you want to apply to go to New Zealand back in the 1990s, the point system would say, do you speak English? If you said no, that was it, 0 points, and there's no way you're going to get in. But they also asked, does your spouse speak English? Because they wanted their spouses to speak English. And if you said no, they said, well, you know, there's a little problem here. You're going to have to put up a bond. I forget the exact amount of the bond, but say it's $20,000. You have to put up $20,000 the day you come in. And we're going to test your wife's English skills in a year. If she passes the test, we'll give you the money back. If she doesn't pass the test, we keep $10,000 right there and then. And you can take it again in 2 years.
They can stay, though, right?
And they could stay.
Okay.
You could take it again in 2 years. If you pass the test, you get the $10,000 left behind back. If you don't pass the test, you lost the bond. So countries have thought about this for a long time. We're not reinventing the wheel, okay, when it comes to the point system. It's been tried and, you know, successfully. By the way, one more thing I should say is that, you know, I teach a class on immigration at Harvard. One of the classes, we usually go through the point system, and we actually take it. So all of us in the class will get the computers out, and in a lot of the countries, you actually can take the test. You act as if you want to go to the country and just literally take the test and see whether you qualify or not. I almost always fail, and I have failed for about 20 years. A lot of the students fail because they don't want the kind of skills that the students want to bring in. You know, they want things that are, like, if you're a chef, there was a point in time in Canada, if you were a chef, my God, you get so many points that you were in Lang Flint almost, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah.
So what does that tell us?
It tells us that people are actually rationally thinking about what it is that the country needs and making decisions as to who to let in based on whatever those bureaucrats decided. Now, it might be that they completely mislead, you know, wrong about what it is they want. On the other hand, we don't have any thinking at all because most of our immigrants come in unfiltered.
Now, my sense is, having lived in this country for many decades, that there's something about the point system that's that intentional that somehow makes the hairs on our backs stand up in this culture. Can you speak to what that might be?
You know, there's something about the point system that's fundamentally un-American, okay? And the way most people come to that is that they go to the Hollywood movies of the Ellis Island era, where you see all these immigrants coming in, the Statue of Liberty, the very emotional aspect of that. And back then, we let in immigrants without any kind of point system. Those immigrants, you know, by now nobody distinguishes them anymore, so it really all worked out. And they actually helped build the manufacturing sector. So they contributed greatly to what the U.S. became in the 20th century. Just to give you an idea, I have a statistic in mind that I've always
found
really...
It's not just Hollywood, though.
What?
It's not just Hollywood movies.
Yeah. But I have a statistic in mind that really tells you what those immigrants were like. In 1917, 1918, two-thirds of the Ford Motor Company workers were foreign-born. You know, just think about that. Yeah. And those foreign-born workers, eventually, those jobs became unionized. Mm-hmm. And those unionized jobs provided jobs to the immigrant, to the children of the immigrant, to the grandchildren. It were like great jobs to hold. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the fact that immigration was unfiltered back then worked out just great given the development of the U.S. economy in the 20th century. Who knows what will happen in the 21st century?
I just think there's some beautiful irony now that now they're probably even more foreign-born because those factories are in Mexico, right? You know, that so many of these auto companies have moved overseas,
right,
and offshored, and, you know, we're trying to get them back. It's a very interesting debate. I mean, we've got an incredibly diverse country with 320 million people, and so I always feel a little reluctant when people talk about Canada and Australia and New Zealand that have like 10 people, you know, and how much easier or different it might be to fashion an immigration system. I definitely see value in a points-based system, but it does put a lot of power, and I think you said this, George, it does put a lot of authority in a small group of federal bureaucrats, sure, makes me a little nervous, you know?
But I would actually go back to your point, which is that, is that what you really want to be America to be about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not an economic question, that's really much more a value question. What kind of country do we want to live in? What kind of values do we want to use to let immigrants in? And no, what I'll say to all that is that, look, there's going to be some number beyond which we will not go.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make decisions, how many to let in and how to pick the people who want to come in. Okay, I mean, just to give you an idea of a statistic, you mentioned the numbers for H-1Bs. We have a visa lottery every year. I think we raffle out 50,000 visas or something like that every year.
That's right.
You know, it's really quite eye-opening when you Google the latest visa report on how many people applied for 50,000 slots. The last time I looked, it was over 20 million people for 50,000 slots.
It's called the Diversity Visa Lottery, and the purpose of it, it's been around for a long time, is that the United States wants, the policy of the lottery program is to attract immigrants from countries that historically do not provide a lot of immigrants to the United States, right? So if you're from India and China and, you know, Canada and the UK, you can't enter this lottery, right? But for just about every African country and many countries in other parts of the world can, and it is very much right now, you know, on the president's hit list, and on other people's hit list as well, because, and I think for some of the reasons that you and I have both spoke about, it's not even tied to family, right? Ties to the United States are completely devoid from the policy behind the diversity visa immigrants. So you have to just, you know, fundamentally, you know, believe in the importance of diverse sets of immigrants coming into the country, because that's all it requires. It's a free application. If you have a high school degree or 2 years of work experience, you can enter this lottery. As George points out, it's slim chances of being selected, but we do still have it, 50,000 every year.
You know, 20 million for 50,000, just think about that. And that gives you an idea of the demand for entering to the U.S., which is why almost, I mean, any immigration policy that you really want to seriously propose is going to have to, and I hate to use this word because it has connotations that I don't want to carry, but that's what we're doing. Immigration policy has to discriminate by its very nature. You know, we used to discriminate on the basis of national origin before 1965. We're now discriminating on the basis of family. People who have family connections have a way greater chance than people who don't.
We had a Chinese Exclusion Act in the beginning of the last century.
We're making decisions right now, discriminating among some, you know, favoring some groups and penalizing other groups, and that's just the nature of the policy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah. Here's our next question. The panel has discussed high-skill workers and the benefit that they add, phrased as, quote, not slicing the pie, but growing the pie. Does this also hold for lower-skilled workers, for example, lower-wage agricultural workers?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, can you...
Just because I don't deal with those programs, I mean, I don't know.
This is the H-2-1 visa?
Or the H-2-A.
H-2A, the ag visas?
Sure.
So what was the question again?
The panel has discussed higher skilled workers and the benefit that they add, phrased as, quote, not slicing the pie, but growing the pie.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Does this also hold for lower skilled workers, for example, low wage agricultural workers?
I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I would say that it does in the sense that, again, using the local example. So you have these families that are here on the H-2A visas. They're working in the agricultural field in the state or in Gallatin County. And those families are participating in the economy. They're consumers. So in that sense, they're contributing to the overall benefit of Montana's economy. Not only are they consumers, but they're also, the longer they're here, they're starting their own businesses. So I don't know how many of you have eaten at Los Jarochos or El Rodeo or these, you know, food trucks that are started by these families. There's cleaning businesses started by these families. So it kind of has a different impact, but I would say it, especially for Gallatin County, it probably has a positive impact at the micro level. I don't know what the implications are, but I'm sure it's true nationally as well, because they're working, but they're also spending, and they're spending a lot. Or as much as any consumer, not the H-2Bs, but...
Yeah. Go ahead, George.
I think one has to then add to that the fiscal impact, which is where the low-skill migration really is very costly. Mm-hmm. You know, the cost of social services, the cost of providing health, schooling, and things like that really is dramatic. So I don't know what the net impact would be because of that.
So I guess I would just say to that point, like I said before, probably there is an impact, and then what do we want to do about the impact? In other words, do we want to integrate members of the community?
No. I would actually one more thing to really check. I'm not going to leave the wrong impression. Suppose that the fiscal impact was negative and substantial, okay? So that on net, low-skill immigration is a negative for the U.S. Does that mean we shouldn't have low-skill immigrants? No. It doesn't mean that at all, okay? with to have low skill demand, you can make a very good humanitarian kind of argument that, you know, we want people who, you know, the U.S. has attracted people throughout history who believe in the American dream.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe people like that are really the people we want. People. Not another programmer, but people who really have that sort of like vision of what America is about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at some, I can actually be convinced about that.
I can convince you. So. Yeah.
Bridget has convinced all of us. Yeah. And, you know, well, in George, in your book, you raise an interesting idea, which is that, you know, who is really benefiting from the lower skilled workers, okay, coming in are the companies that hire them.
Right.
And if they're the ones making the profit, you know, the question is, hey, you know, what kind of levers could we employ to maybe have them share some of that profit for the well-being of,
the
immigrants.
And
it's a fair question, I think.
We tend not to tax the people who gain most from immigration to help the people who are hurt by immigration. And if we did that, we would have a very different immigration policy, I think, because it would make employers internalize the cost of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's politically, it's almost impossible to get to that level.
Yeah. So interesting ideas. Okay. All right, on another topic, what about refugees? Are the people at the border now applying for refugee status? Is there a quota? How many in the quota?
So I can take that a little bit. I actually just volunteered at the U.S.-Mexico border a couple of months ago. I wrote an essay about it, which I can share with you if you'd like, about my experience there. So the answer to the basic question is yes. The president, any president, right, sets the level of refugee admissions every year. I think this year it's 4,000, but definitely not my, you know, day-to-day practice, but it's about 4,000. At least based on my experience providing pro bono legal services at a detention center in South Texas, I mean, you know, the stories that I heard, and my job was to do intake and interview these families to try to understand whether or not they had a colorable claim for asylum under the law, and to try to write up those arguments so that whoever attended their asylum interviews could explain them to an asylum officer. I mean, and to say that there were themes in these stories is a proverbial understatement, right? There's a tremendous amount of gang violence, and everybody knows that if you have a son, once that son reaches a certain age of 15 or 16, you know, they will be approached and conscripted or attempted conscription, you know, into these gangs, and the costs of refusing or the family refusing to allow the sons to enter the gangs can be very costly, depending on the community. For a lot of these families, that, you know, I think they feel that their only opportunity for their families is to try to get to the United States and apply for asylum. Now, interestingly, at the moment, the fleeing from domestic or gang violence is not a legal grounds for asylum. That's the position of that was the position of Attorney General Sessions, and I believe continues to be the position of the Justice Department. And so, these cases, and this, I promise this isn't a legal lecture, but just because someone asked the question, I'll give you a little bit about what I know. So what you need to try to argue is that the asylum or refugee law is about fear of persecution, right? That if someone is to return to their home country, they have a well-founded fear of persecution. Claims that might work would be sort of these fears of domestic and gang violence coupled with some other discrete or insular quality. So, for example, and compared to the two of you, my Spanish I know is terrible, But you know, it was the only enjoyment actually these clients at the border got was my broken Spanish, and interviewing them. But what's really what you learn is that a lot of individuals that live in Central America, Spanish is not their first language. That there are these indigenous languages down there that serve as yet another form of social stratification and discrimination against them, and sometimes there's arguments in that way. I don't want to get too far afield from the question, but there is a quota. It's extremely difficult. I don't know whether it rises to the quote-unquote emergency that we're hearing about, but it is quite serious.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Andrew. Great. Okay. Well, you know, I guess related. Okay. Let's do this one. What are the pros and cons of closing the border to deal with the immigration issue? Who wants to take this one?
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I guess famous last words, right?
Can we quote you on that?
It is not going to happen. I mean, I remember so vividly the moment that I heard that LaGuardia Airport was shutting down when we had the government shut down. I said, just count to 10, this government shutdown is going to end, right? The president is going to get some calls from his buddies in New York that cannot get on their flights to wherever, and it's going to end, and it ended, right? I think the consequences of just full out shutting down the border and preventing any goods and services from coming across the border, I can't imagine that that's going to happen, but you heard it here if it happens.
I have several colleagues who are economists who can't wait for it to happen because they'll provide all kinds of data. So they're already dreaming. They're already dreaming of the papers that can be written in the next year if we actually had this natural experiment. So that's where, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, people tend to usually predict debacles or nothing. Probably something in the middle is more likely the answer. But, you know, as an economist, wow, let's get the data.
I'll cross my fingers for you, George.
But it's also an extreme, right? I mean, really what needs to be done, and I know you said Congress can't get past anything, but we need immigration reform. I think we would all agree on that. And the fact that, you know, this is how we address it by shutting down the border is I don't want to use the word sad, but it's kind of, I don't want to use the word pathetic. What is it? It's
But you literally are using those words.
Right. It's terrible that because we cannot pass immigration reform with the questions that you raised at the beginning, with what you're saying, we're going to this extreme.
Mm-hmm. So, right. Well, you know, that's what's interesting is also that, well, the current population of immigrants in this country, I believe, is, like I said, the 44 million, which represents a little less than 14% of the total U.S. population. And maybe you can speak to some of the trends in immigration, because used to be mostly immigrants from Mexico and Latin America, you know, since the 1970s. But then recently now, like, you know, Andrew was mentioning, it's more from Asia. You know, India and China. So the whole scene has changed. And so this whole border controversy, you know, where do we sit with that? You know, how relevant is it? Don't know, you know. Yeah,
I mean, I think if you look, it's not just illegal drugs that come across the Mexican border every day, right? I mean, there is so much commerce that the United States does with Mexico every day, let alone people, you know, just coming. I mean, you know, there's tons of U.S. citizens, right, that are living in Mexico at the border with their families who don't have any U.S. status that come to go to school every day in the United States. I mean, it would be horrific if the border was closed, and I think that the backlash would be bipartisan and insane. But I could be wrong. But I don't think so. I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay. Great. Here's our next question. Is
outsourcing or immigration responsible for wage regression over, say, the past 20 years?
For wage what?
Wage regression? Which, I mean, what would that right. mean to you? Does that mean depression
I'll
of wages?
I'll rephrase it in the way that we studied it, which is really a wage inequality. Is trade, outsourcing in general, but trade and or immigration, which is really globalization in general, responsible for increasing inequality in this country? We know that inequality in this country has been rising since 1980, and it's not just in this country, in many other countries. In a lot of developed countries, in a lot of industrialized economies, this is more inequality today than it was back in 1980. And, you know, I don't think there's much doubt anymore that both immigration and trade have contributed to increased inequality. By the way, the impact of trade, in the old days, economists would never have said a bad word about trade because we know free trade is good. That's what we've been taught since Ricardo's time 200 years ago. But there's a lot of papers in the last 10 years which show that the trade, you know, with China particularly, had a pretty negative impact on the manufacturing sector in parts of the U.S. like the Midwest. So there's no doubt that there's an impact. Whether it's the main impact, that's very doubtful. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we don't really know what the main reason is for the increased inequality, so we've come up with a technical jargon to explain it, and the technical jargon that we use is skill bias technical change. That's the jargon we use to explain the thing we don't really know about. And what it basically means is it means a technological shift in the U.S. and industrialized economies that favored skilled workers for whatever reason, like the information revolution, the computer revolution. So we don't know what the main reason was, but we call it that. Immigration and trade have an impact, but it is by no means, you know, even remotely close to being that the most important.
So, you know, I don't know if the questioner would like to reveal him or herself, but when you asked the question, I sort of thought about if the questioner was talking about IT outsourcing and whether or not outsourcing of jobs to technology companies is suppressing the wages of U.S. workers. Was that question? It was? So that's it's a great question, and you know, in full disclosure, I represent a lot of IT consulting companies. Now, I also represent their customers as well, and I think the truth of the matter is that it probably does a little, but I don't know that it's in the way that we ordinarily think about it, because again, these so-called outsourcers are spending a lot of money to bring employees into the United States, and I think a couple of things are going on. One, I think a lot of the outsourcers are bringing in existing employees that may work for their overseas operations, and so integrating them into a U.S. project, they may seem as, you know, easier than the U.S. workers that may have worked for the company whose IT department, for example, is being outsourced. But one other thing that we hear about that, you know, I think is really interesting is that, at least in the technology sector, that the temporary immigrant workers are more flexible than Americans in terms of their job locations, and that, at least in the technology services arena, the industry is very project-based. So you may work on a project for a year or 18 months or 2 years in, I don't know, Cincinnati, and then another customer needs you to work in Des Moines. And I have no empirical study to back this up, but I do know what my clients tell me, which is that Americans often say they will not do that. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Indian IT professional that is just over the moon with this opportunity to come and learn in the United States say, put me anywhere, you know, just give me an opportunity to learn and grow. And that doesn't mean we have to accept that, you know, as a country we could say, all right, well, we need to mitigate that through some other laws or policies to, I don't know, make it so that Americans
can keep these jobs and not have to move. I don't know how we would do that. But that's what I hear.
Very good. Thank you. And yeah, I think we've approached our time today. So I would like to thank our panelists today for an excellent discussion, and for all of our audience members, especially those of you who submitted very stimulating questions, and those whose questions didn't get answered, but we couldn't answer all of them, but I thank you very much. Can we give our panelists a big round of applause?